So about 2 weeks ago, I went to Bunnings for a piece of hardware. They didn't stock what I wanted, so I headed off to Mitre 10 instead. And there's nothing unusual about this at all. They're a business, and I'm a consumer. They supply the products that I may want to purchase. That is a commercial relationship. But it's also not a terribly deep relationship. I don't have a terribly deep relationship with Bunnings or Mitre 10. That's because the relationship is consumer-driven. They are designed to provide customer satisfaction. That is the nature of my relationship with them. But herein lies a problem. There is often a tendency, even amongst Christians, to think of churches as similar entities. They think of church as a shop which stocks various products called spirituality, or preaching, or worship, or friendship, or home groups, or parenting courses, and the congregation simply is there to consume the merchandise. This consumer-driven, customer satisfaction understanding of the church, according to the Apostle Paul, has got to go. It cannot be part of the Christian mindset. It may be how we treat a hardware store or a supermarket, but it is woefully inadequate to think of church in those same consumer categories. So firstly then, if the apostle is going to teach us not to approach the church like consumers, how ought we to relate to the church? What is the right way to relate to our church community? Well, firstly, it helps to remember that church is not a business or a building, but a community of the covenant people of God. And therefore, it is reasonable to see that our relationships are, in fact, integral to the church. The way that we relate to one another is integral to church. And those relationships are to be marked by a characteristic to love one another. We are right to think about Jesus' teaching at this point, where he said, "By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." So make note of this then. Church is not meant to be understood as another commercial institution, but a community in which the covenant people of God contribute toward one another. And one way in which we contribute toward one another is to love one another well. Our contribution of love is very important. The Thessalonians were a commendable example at this. They were really hitting the strides with this love toward one another. Have a look at verses 9 through to 10. The apostle wrote, "Concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you. For you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia." In these verses, I want you to see a couple of interesting details. There are a couple of things for us to note that's really important. The apostle commended the Thessalonian church for their brotherly love. The root word is philadelphia. It describes the kind of love shared between siblings, brothers and sisters, siblings, that kind of gritty kind of love that you experience in a family. It's this kind of familial love that was very important to those who first became Christians. It was also important for those who become Christians in modern times also. So both in ancient times and in modern times, brotherly love was a really important part of church life. One difficulty that many converts faced and do still face today when they become Christians is that they are shunned by their family. Because they have abandoned the traditional household religion or the customary religion of their people, they are often shunned, they are often ostracized by their own families. And the ancient Christians knew this, and many modern Christians experienced this also when their family just cuts ties with them. But what these new Christians then found in the church was a new family. They found for themselves new family, new brothers, new sisters, new family to relate to one another. It was a patchwork quilt of people united in one faith that Jesus' life, death, and resurrection atoned for their sins, and that this Christ is now crowned Lord above all. They were united in their faith and therefore were constituted as a new family. One historian points out the essential nature of this family kind of love that these new Christians found. Gene Green is a Christian historian, professor of the New Testament, and he wrote the following: "The question of fraternal love was of paramount importance, since the church was open to people of all social classes and any ethnic background. Both the free and the slave were welcome, while Greeks, Romans, Macedonians, Jews, and barbarians gathered together to share the same cup in the worship of their one Lord. Men and women had equal status, as did citizens and foreigners in this community, where common social boundaries were crossed as a fruit of their common salvation." So this family kind of love among the church is different too from the general kind of love with which Christians are to have toward everyone. We are to love our neighbor as ourselves. We are to love unilaterally across the board, but we are to especially love the household of faith. It's this kind of fraternal love that is focused. It is specific because Christians recognize one another as fellow members in the household of God. You and I are family in God's household. We are brothers and sisters in the household of God. That is what all true Christians indeed are. If you are a Christian, one of the things that God has done for you is to adopt you. He gave you siblings, he gave you a new family, and he gave you his family name, and he wrote you into his inheritance. You get all that he has because you are now his family. Another disciple of Jesus said it this way. He said, "See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God." And so we are. That's the kind of love that God has given us. He has drawn us into his own family, called us his own children, and so we are. We really are that, siblings in the household of God. And the Thessalonians were handling this family kind of love very well indeed. They were doing it well. They were contributing, they were meeting needs, they were providing for one another, they were supplying, sharing, giving, all in a very unconsumeristic way. They went against the grain of consumerism. This was the heartbeat of the Thessalonian church. They were doing this well, mostly. Mostly. I say mostly because all Christian churches are, of course, realistic churches. They are realistic communities. Not everything is always as loving as we might like to be. Not everything is always as good as it could be. Not everything glitters all the time. Not every person in a church is always a shining example of spiritual health. And I know this to be true of myself, and maybe you have come to recognize that about yourself also in time. So notice what the encouragement is of the Apostle Paul in verse 10. It says, you're doing really well in this family kind of love. You're doing it great. You don't even need me to write to you about this anymore. You've been taught by God. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more. They weren't perfect at it. They were doing well, but they weren't perfect. There was always room for improvement. There's always room to do it more and more. Paul was realistic about Christian life this way. He knew brotherly love was often imperfectly expressed. And so we are encouraged to love more and more. On this side of heaven, there is always room for improvement. Always. And this is one of those reality checks we need from time to time, isn't it? Especially if we're looking at our churches with a consumer-minded mindset, if we're looking for customer satisfaction from our churches, this is a really good moment just to stop and to think what is implied by those words, more and more. See, if we arrive at our churches looking to consume, looking what we can get out of it, looking what we can devour from other people, expecting fully stocked shelves of the highest quality love available on the market, we are in for a disappointment when people begin to fail us and fail our expectations. It reminds me of something that Dietrich Bonhoeffer once wrote in his book, Life Together. Bonhoeffer was, of course, growing up in the war era and was eventually hanged for opposing Hitler. But he wrote about church life, trying to experience it as fully as any person possibly could on this side of heaven. He wrote, those who love their dream of a Christian community more than they love the Christian community itself become destroyers of that Christian community, even though their personal intentions may be ever so honest and earnest and sacrificial. He goes on and he says, they enter the community of Christians with their demands set up by their own law and judge one another and God accordingly. See, Bonhoeffer knew how to wreck Christian community. He knew what it took to wreck Christian community. If we turn up with our demands. So let's be honest, if we stick around any church for long enough, and you will find something to disappoint you. There will be someone who bugs you. There will be some aspect of what we do as a Christian community that you wish we would do better. There are lots of reasons for disappointment. The coffee may not be to your liking, and the morning tea a little bit flimsy sometimes. Sometimes it's a bit hot, and sometimes it's a bit cold, and there's just many, many things that disappoints us if we come to church looking for customer satisfaction as our highest value. And so this is why I have come to love the apostle's words, where he tells us to love more and more. There's always room to love better, to overlook a few things, to cover all kinds of sins with love for one another, to bear with one another, to be patient with one another. See, of all people, Christians know that they haven't arrived at perfection. In some way, I, along with others, will disappoint you with our imperfect love. But we are willing to listen and learn from the scriptures, and we are eager to seek the growth that God invites us to. In this way, we aspire to contribute to the love of our Christian churches and to the health of our Christian churches, rather than just settling to consume whatever there is to consume in our Christian churches. And this brings us to the core problem the apostle now had to deal with. There is a root issue that is being dealt with here. A small number of Christians were treating their church like Bunnings. They were treating it like their Mitre 10. They were there to consume without contributing. They were there to take without giving. Have a look at verses 11 through to 12. The problem is implied by these commandments. We urge you, brothers, to do this more and more and to aspire to live quietly and to mind your own affairs and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may live properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. Within the Thessalonian church, a small number of people refused to work. They refused to work and instead were living off the generosity of other well-intentioned and well-meaning Christians. We're not 100% sure of even why they were doing this. It may be that some of them had heard Paul say that the Lord Jesus is coming back, and we'll look at that next week, and they thought, well, if that's going to happen, I might as well stop work and just enjoy the time that I have left. More recent scholarship have pointed out that there was a systematic patronage at work in ancient cultures, where very wealthy patrons often sponsored other people in exchange for influence and for votes and for popularity and so on in the social strata. So we're not 100% sure, but we can make some educated guesses. A small number of these Christians in the Thessalonian church gave up work and refused to work altogether. And this kind of freeloading socialism, the apostle teaches, cannot be part of the Christian life. But let me clear up a couple of misunderstandings before I go on. The issue here is not Christians who want to work but cannot for the sake of health, or for being elderly, or for being a student, or for some kind of trauma that's entered your life, or for lack of job availability, or because you've been made redundant, or whether you're a parent who chooses to stay home and take care of the kids and do homemaking. There are many, many valid reasons for not being employed in a taxable income. Many valid and good reasons. Paul is not addressing those kinds of issues. Paul is specifically addressing those Christians who are available and able to work, and the work can be found, and yet they willfully choose to be lazy. That's who he's talking about. Willful laziness, which burdens the church with their care. At heart, these kinds of Christians were consumers of church resources without sharing the responsibility of contributing to their church. So how would the apostle have consumer-minded Christians like that think about becoming contributing Christians? How will he shift consumers to becoming contributors? How will he make people who are always there just to take and to get into giving and being supportive members of their churches? Well, he gives us a couple of reasons here, or a couple of motives here. He says, firstly, aspire to live quietly. That's the first point there. This is not so much saying don't be noisy. Don't be the kind of neighbor that gets noise patrol called on you routinely in the weekends. That's not really what's implied here by the word aspire to live quietly. Rather, it's saying live in such a way that you're not being a disruption to others, that you're not a disruption to them all the time and burdensome on other people's resources. Secondly, we are to mind our own affairs. We are not to be prying busybodies, looking for that next juicy bit of gossip on other people's lives and their shortcomings and their failings. We are instead to mind our own affairs. We are to look after our own personal holiness firstly. That's what we want to be doing. So live quietly, grow in your own holiness, and then thirdly, we are to work with our hands. Work with your hands, the apostle says. When Paul says work with your hands, he is not prohibiting office work. He is simply pointing a small number of consumer-minded Christians in the direction of meaningful and dignified and contributive employment. Saying do something, do anything, but do something. Work for your income. And this brings us into contact with the Christian view of work as a positive and good endeavor. A good many people don't like work because they find nothing redeeming or valuable about it. It's just simply an ugly burden that they have to carry. Some years ago, a Christian teaching series called the Truth Project, the presenter asked various people what they thought about work. He would go into the street and say, "Wait, what do you think about work? What is work to you?" And he received various answers like, "It's a bummer," or "It's what I have to do for money," or "It's the only way to get to Friday." I think that's probably my favorite. What do you think about work? "It's the only way I can get to Friday." Well, not everyone thinks about work as positive or worthwhile. It is uniquely Christian to understand work in good and positive terms, that industrious work is a good thing. That is one of the things contributed to Western society directly from the Protestant Reformation. It is Protestants who valued work as a good thing because they recognized that work was given to humanity, was given to our first parents before sin entered the world. God gave Adam and Eve work to do before sin entered the world, and therefore they recognized that work is a good thing to do. That work is a positive thing to do. It is a God-given thing to do. The problem, of course, is that sin did enter the world. It did make work difficult and frustrating at times. Sin did enter the world, and that means work itself was spoiled by sin. That our work has been tainted by sin. Adam was told right after the fall of Genesis 3, Adam receives these words from the Lord. He says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." All his work has been made difficult from the fall onwards. The work is still there. The work is still to be done, but it's now a frustration. There's a difficulty to it. What was once a blessing now carries all kinds of frustrations. The government takes our wealth and taxes. Our motives wane. Our best efforts cannot always cure cancer. Our bodies ache in time. Thorns and thistles have invaded our work. And to this, notice this, Paul lives in the real world. He knows work is difficult. He knows motives aren't always pure. He knows it can be hard to get out of bed in the morning and do the same job again and again and again. And even so, he says to the Thessalonians, work with your hands. Don't give up. Don't give up on the whole thing altogether. Don't give in to laziness. Don't throw in the towel. Redeem the dignity of your work. Use your work to sustain yourself and to provide for your family and to contribute to the needs of others. Do something good with the work that you have been given to do. Why? Verse 12, so that you may live properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. Note that phrase, live properly. There's a story of Charles Spurgeon who once asked a young maid, how do you know you've become a Christian? You still have the same job that you did before you became a Christian. You have the same job now. How do you know that you've become a Christian? And the young maid said to him, I now sweep under the mats. And that captures the idea, doesn't it? To live properly before outsiders. It's not necessarily saying you now need to change your job and do something completely different. Maybe you do if you've got a job that's steeped in sin, but most likely not. You are to remain in the call, in the vocation in which you are called. But you now sweep under the mats. You live properly before the outsiders. You're not looking at doing the bare minimum at work or what you can get away with. You are setting a new standard. You are raising the bar. You are living properly before outsiders so that they might see your good works and give thanks to your Father who is in heaven. The application of all of this is twofold. In Christian community, it is right to elevate a generous brotherly love within our fellowship above a general love for all people. As Paul taught elsewhere, when he said, so then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. Do good to everyone, especially to those in the household of faith. Secondly, that generous love is not to be taken advantage of by a few consumers. The discipleship offered by Christ is to help Western consumer-minded individuals like ourselves to become contributing providers. That is the discipleship that Christ offers us, to resist consuming and become contributing people, so that we might pump oxygen into the lungs of the church instead of sucking the life out of it. And we do this with our eyes firmly fixed on the gospel at all times. This is not some kind of moralism for you to live up to. This is an implication of the gospel. So our eyes are firmly fixed on the gospel at all times. We love, we show a generous love because we have been loved by God to the point where he had given his son for our redemption. This is the greatest demonstration of love ever conceived. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends, according to Jesus. And we are learning to become contributors because we imitate our generous God, who has supplied fully and generously what was required for our salvation. He gave us a perfect sacrifice, an able redeemer, a faithful older brother, the Christ of Scripture. Amen.